I'm Wing from the Starling Tribune, a podcast member of the Gunna Geek Network, just like the one you're listening to now. The opinions expressed are those of each individual. Check out all other podcasts at GunnaGeekNetwork.com and get ready because geekiness begins in 3, 2, 1.
Welcome to Gallifrey Public Radio, a podcast dedicated to everything Doctor Who. Join us each week for discussion ranging from Hartnell to Capaldi. I'm your host, Jay Witten.
I prefer to jazzercise my demons, but yeah.
And my co-host, Haley Malley.
I am a ray of sunshine.
And Keir Hansen.
Flashy lights, Christmas, woo!
Spoilers.
We will be discussing news and rumors, as well as episodes that have already aired. But don't worry, if we get into anything too serious, we'll warn you again. Welcome to episode 121 of Gallifrey Public Radio, where we decide to buck tradition, fight the limitless power that is Tumblr, and actually defend Doctor Who showrunner Stephen Moffat. Call for a priest, gather whatever holy relics you might feel safe, and utter all the prayers you deem necessary, because surely the end times are upon us. I am Jay, and with me this week is Keir. How are you doing, Keir?
I'm good so far. We'll see when the torches and the pitchforks start showing up outside the studio here.
Oh yeah, they're coming. Yeah, unfortunately, Haley has contracted the plague again, so she is not with us this week. But she's one for one
against the plague. You know, she's doing well. She's batting 1,000.
Yeah. So she squeaked her apologies and wanted us to let everybody know that she wishes she could be here, but you know, we didn't want to assault her eardrums like that.
No, there's so many filters you can run through that'll get rid of phlegm. But yeah, so what's going to be happening tonight is, well, looking back, it has probably not been since the days of John Nathan Turner that an executive producer for Doctor Who has garnered so much criticism, or you might even go so far as saying hatred, from the majority of the fan base. But unlike JNT's radical changes around the Colin Baker era that were seen, or you know, Colin Baker going into all the way up through Sylvester McCoy, that many will try to blame him as the reason why by 1989 they ended up wrapping the show, Moffat has seen Doctor Who as a franchise reach its absolute peak, unthinkable heights that we have attained, and has become a household name with a global audience, more so than it had in any of the 50 years prior. So lest we be labeled as simply pandering mouthpieces for the viewing audience, even though we are, we've decided to step forward and commend this Lilliputian Scotsman for his many, and that's right, we did say many, contributions to the show's ongoing legacy. So go ahead, grab your red Sharpie, mark your calendars, and be sure to put on some flame retardant pajamas, because this is a once in a lifetime event that is likely to burn some bridges.
Oh yeah, yeah, I would not be surprised if we get quite a bit of hate mail over this one, but
fine, my eyes can take it.
So, real quick, we'll start with some of Haley's thoughts that she threw out to us before we started recording. And her main point was that she said, I think Moffat's strength is really in his writing. He needs to work on his administrative skills to round himself out as a showrunner.
Okay. Well, that's an excellent lead into some of the things that we want to take apart tonight, because understand, I mean, really, when you think about it, the whole term as showrunner is a recent development. You know, these programs have had their executive producers and production staffs. Mm-hmm. They have had writers and head writers. And at times, there's been a little bit of crossover and bleed through with those roles, along with the individual who normally would sit as the head of drama production for BBC or BBC Wales. So you've got a lot of players involved in it, and it's been how recent would you say that the whole premise of calling someone a showrunner who is responsible for overseeing, you know, all of these aspects of the franchise as well as the creative direction of the show?
You know, I've really only heard the term thrown around in either American or British TV. I've heard it used in both, but I've really only heard it in the past, I want to say, like 5 or 6 years.
Okay. I might have placed that a little bit farther back.
I'm estimating here.
Right. Well, I mean, some of the things, just in recent news, I mean, we just came around on the 10th anniversary of the pilot episode for Battlestar Galactica. You know, people were talking about Ronald Moore and saying, you know, that they've always referred to him as sort of the showrunner because that was his concept and his baby. Take Eric Kripke for Supernatural, things of that sort. So there's individuals who have been not only the ones to see everything go to film, or go to tape or whatever, but there's also the ones that have that sit back and say, well, I have a story I want to tell as well,
right?
And I'm going to have other individuals involved with conveying that story, but I have a path. So you know, I sort of personally take showrunner on as something that encompasses all of those things. So Haley's point about knowing that his strengths really reside first and foremost in his writing, and saying that if there's any areas that really need to get some improvement or to round himself out, as she said, as a showrunner, have to be more on his administrative skills. That's another component of it that I think a lot of people in their Moffat hate tend to look past, because we are consumers of stories. Mm-hmm. So we look to that, and if the story isn't something that entertains us or makes us feel the way we want to feel at the moment, that's who you go after.
Right.
So I don't know. I mean, how do you feel about, you know, the we'll start with the writing side. Okay. Because that's obviously, since that's something that hits us first and lasts, you know, that's the thing that people tend to carry closest to their hearts.
Right. So if you look at some of the, you know, some of the episodes that Stephen Moffat has written just for Doctor Who, if we look at just Doctor Who episodes, you know, the first ones that we came across were, you know, the Empty Child and the Doctor Dances. Mm-hmm. And, you know, quite a few people, myself included, call those the best of series one.
Yep.
You know, I mean, those are absolutely my favorite from series one. Series two was Girl in the Fireplace. You know, again, my personal favorite from the series. You know, then series three, Blink. I mean, how many people use Blink as their introduction into Doctor Who? That's
absolutely. Yeah.
Series four was, Silence in the Library and Forest of the Dead. I mean, very, very powerful stuff.
Right.
You know, and so, I mean, even before he got to be showrunner, he proved he knows how to write. I mean, if you look on his IMDb, his writing credits go back to 1990. So it's not like he's new to this kind of thing, you know?
Yeah, exactly.
And I mean, his first credited role as writer for Doctor Who was for the comic relief for the Curse of Fatal Death.
Right.
And I mean, I don't know if anyone has seen that, but that is absolutely hilarious and sharp. It is brilliantly written.
Right. But it's still, even that, people, and I was actually, because I was going over a number of tumblers of people that have gotten so much, you know, have gotten their hatred for Moffat under their skin to such a point that they were even taking that apart.
Oh, geez.
You're taking apart a satirical comedy benefit sketch and taking it apart because it was unfunny. Because it utilized excessive sarcasm and irony as their comedic tools. Like,
Have you watched British TV?
You've just cut the legs out under 50% of their programming. But it's just it's a matter of, you know, as I said, it's as a consumer, if it's something that you don't want at that moment and it rubs you the wrong way, or if you had different expectations, or if you were waiting for a different payout at the end of an episode, or whatever the case may be, or if it's just something that isn't, you know, I am willing to say right now that there are a large percentage of anti-Moffat Whovians who simply don't like him because his writing doesn't involve David Tennant anymore. And I'm sorry, the man is not on the program anymore. You know, the show evolves. Mm-hmm. There have been different individuals over the course of the 50 years who have taken the position of saying, I am working with a new lead actor who is capable of doing different things, so we're going to take a slightly different direction with the show. You have to understand that some of the casting decisions to be able to put Matt Smith in the position were entirely Moffat's, and Smith is endeared to a huge percentage of Doctor Who viewers. So if you're going to say that, you know, yeah, you brought in a great guy, and I love him to death, but man, the stuff you wrote was garbage. Well, then, I'm sorry, you cannot separate the two, because it is part of a creative work that is put forth to the viewing audience.
Okay, let me ask you this, because when they picked Stephen Moffat to be showrunner, they weren't sure if David Tennant was actually going to be leaving or not. Like, in the early stages, it was still assumed that Tennant was actually going to be in the show. Mm-hmm. So Moffat wrote series like the 11th Hour more as a start to finish kind of thing, where we were going to see at the end of it how, you know, when he came out of the TARDIS all beat up and stuff, and then we were going to see what happened before that, and it was just going to kind of, you know, a lot of his timey-wimey stuff. So,
right.
Do you think that if he had gotten one season with Tennant, do you think that there would be the level of hate that there is?
I think so, because he creates a different program than what RTD brought back to us in 2005. And it's just a matter of if that storytelling mechanism or that construct is something that isn't as... And you got to say, you know, with a couple of exceptions, RTD's era was very squeaky clean to a certain degree. And some of the moments where they got darkest were moments when Moffat was writing. So
yeah, that's very true.
Despite the fact that he's been criticized, you know, even by us at times, as not being able to put the final knife in a character or whatever the case may be, some, you know, there's grains of truth to a lot of the criticism that he receives. But by the same token, you know, the show was not in any sort of perfect state prior.
Oh no!
And as we mentioned, you know, with John Nathan Turner. And even other executive producers prior, or even head writers prior, they had been lambasted on a regular basis by a certain percentage of the viewing audience who just wanted a different story.
Mm-hmm. So, you know, as much as people may want to point the finger at various, you know, things, say, oh, no, Moffat sucks because of this and because of that. And, you know, everybody's got their reason to point. If you have one thing that you can't stand about him, I just want to point out that it was RTD who created the Slitheens and Aliens in London. That was an RTD penned episode.
Right.
So, you know, either you are a huge fan of fart jokes with, you know, big green aliens, or you just can't separate yourself from one incident.
That's true. Yeah. I mean, there. I look at it as this is an individual who has made it very clear over the now, you know, going on 20, nearing 20 years of involvement in some capacity with the program, that has proven himself to be a consummate fan of the show.
Oh yeah.
I mean, very few people involved in the program right now at any level, maybe other than Capaldi himself, are such, you know, deep rooted, long standing fans of the show and know it as well as they do.
Mm-hmm. You know, and that's one thing that, you know, really comes out is you can tell that he is a fan of the show, and everything he's done has been it's been a labor of love. You can tell that this is written by somebody who knows the show, who may not agree with your personal interpretation of it, but who clearly loves the show and wants it to continue.
Mm-hmm. And that's something too. Whenever I start hearing people getting into their basis for why they're bashing the man in the chair, and they'll say, well, you know, he's just trying to destroy the program. What I can't even fathom the justification for that sort of an argument. Or they say it's something like he's setting it up so that when he leaves, anyone who takes over is going to be walking into a disaster and he will be killing the program. There's absolutely, I cannot think of other individuals who want to see the franchise succeed for another 50 years. Mm-hmm. Because as he's proven, whether you agree with a lot of his writing choices or his story paths or any of the ways that he executes it, you cannot deny the fact that he loves the show, whether he's the one writing it or not.
Yeah. Yeah, and that's one thing that I've actually heard him said is, you know, he's actually come out and said, I write the kind of stuff I'd like to watch. Mm-hmm. And that's what it boils down to is this is the, you know, when you're a writer, that's what you do. You write the kind of things that you find interesting. You know, if you're just writing, pandering to your audience and not really, your heart's not in it, you're not going to get very far and you're going to quit before too long.
Right. Yeah. And taking it one step from writing to production, I mean, you've heard Terrence Dix say it quite often, nobody chooses to be a producer.
Yeah.
know, you end up becoming a producer because you either got suckered into it or no one else would take the gig or whatever the case may be. He had plenty of an opportunity. You know, he was, you consider him to be, you know, one of the grandfathers of the program over the decades. And he would not want to have a production position because he enjoyed writing the stories that he wrote. So he chose not to leap that wall. When Moffat gets into that position and has the opportunity to be able to see to the franchise as a business as well as a craft, now you're dealing with something, you know, as we're talking about this, this rise of the showrunner position is not an enviable position by any stretch.
No.
And then one of the things that goes along with that, you know, sort of that newly fangled title is you become the designated target.
Well, I mean, it's because it is such a hugely publicized position. There's, you know, most of the people that sit down and watch the show, they're not going to recognize the writers or the directors' names. They know Stephen Moffat's name, but they're not going to recognize, you know, the, oh, well, this is the guy that was, you know, the, I blame it on the script editor because that's what it, no, they're going to blame Stephen Moffat because that's the name they know.
Precisely. Yeah. And there are, and this is one of the things that, you know, as a producer, I wanted to make sure that I gave lip service to, because there are other individuals, you know, working in the higher ranks of BBC Wales that have done such a commendable job just within the last couple of years of helping the show as it has gained more and more traction and more popularity and more global outreach and more mainstream media acceptance and so forth. And that has to do with the rest of the production staff. So, you figure, you know, when RTD exited and he took with him Julie Gardner, and the two of them were just an amazing team together as far as their craft, you know, but you've got, you know, Pierce Wegner came in and sort of, you know, took the helm there and didn't really, was kind of a rather unsung hero in that regard of being able to see the successes of series 5 and 6. Along with Beth Willis. Now, and series 7, we know what it was, and there are some formulaic reasons behind, you know, why that had some stumbling blocks too. But then most recently, and I've mentioned the man's name a couple of times over the course of this past series, but bringing in Brian Minchin has been an amazing addition, because he is equally as much of a long span fan of the program in its full history as well. And I think he gets what, not only what Moffat wants to bring to fruition, but I think he understands just as much as Moffat does from an exec producer position, what his talent is capable of, what his writers are capable of producing with the right encouragement or the right coaxing or the right nudge. And that's why, you know, whether we're alone in this for thinking so or not, why I think Series 8 has been such a success.
Yeah.
So the part of being, you know, the man at the top is you've got your cabinet, and I think he has a very effective one by his selection.
Yeah. One of the things I did want to mention, though, we did get a listener who, and I'll go ahead and read everything that he sent to us, but he makes a very good point in here that he says that, does he need a PR manager to do the interviews for him? Maybe. And I think that that's a great point, is the fact that, you know, Moffat is a brilliant writer and he's done a decent job as showrunner. He is not the most eloquent person, and he's not exactly great when you stick the microphone in his face and start to ask him questions.
Yeah. Yeah. So, I see Ben's point on that. And I think that is one of the things that goes along with the position that is just a little bit tough, is that if you are not the most diplomatic about your choice of words in direct interviews, he may be a wordsmith,
yeah,
but he's also very passionate about his work. And at any point where it starts to feel like he's being attacked or is being, you know, sort of picked apart in an interview or something of that, or he's getting very pointed questions, he doesn't always react that well. He doesn't always choose his words quite as deftly as he would if he were speaking through his characters. Mm-hmm. Nor is he one to bear fools gladly. Think about all the attacks that would come raining down on him through Twitter, you know, the reasons why he's no longer found on the social media anymore.
Yeah. But I mean, you know, a good example of that too is look at some of the crap that we heard from Jenna Coleman over Series 8. You know, some people are great at their craft and they're very, very good when you put them in their element. If you take them out of their element and start to, you know, pick them apart, it starts to break down. Yeah. So, Yeah, I tend to try and give him a little bit more leeway when he's, you know, in front of an interviewer's microphone instead of behind a writing desk.
Right. Yeah. I think it's, a lot of it has to be just a reaction to the general tone that he's getting. You can see in some of the interviews that he does, whether it's for the Radio Times or for whoever else that he's speaking with as far as publications go, if it's something where I think he and the interviewer are having a mutual enjoyment of the topic, then he's sort of forthcoming. He provides a little bit of information. He gives us one of these little tidbits of info that we didn't have prior that give us some newsworthy points that we can hit because he's feeling comfortable enough to share some things.
Mm-hmm.
But the moment where it becomes a why did you or why didn't you or what were you thinking when, if the interview is not over right there and then, then it's not going to be anything terribly informative. It's going to start to fall back on a lot of the repetitions and the sort of the practiced phrases that he's had to fall into.
It's so going
to
be a cracker of an episode.
Precisely. You know, because that's the safe out, you know, rather than getting into some sort of a dissection of his work to date.
Mm-hmm.
But okay, so let's come back to that for a second. That work to date, we know, you know, his wider scope body of work, you know, and the opportunities he's had working for things like Coupling or writing on, working with Gatiss on Sherlock and things of that sort. And he's and he's constantly involved. He, whether you recognize it or not, he has his hands in a lot of different projects that are typically not something his name is on as well, because he's just he is a fan of good programming like the rest of us. So I think he genuinely enjoys seeing other material and consuming this media. So what out of where we perceive his strengths to be as a writer, where do you think that stems from? You know, where do you think when we sit back and we say, okay, we see his name on the writing credits for an upcoming episode, what are you hoping that's going to contain so that you know he's writing in his element?
I'm hoping that there are no action sequences first off.
Okay.
I would say that it's more about his ability to connect with the audience, to give the audience the kind of emotion that they're hoping for.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. If you go back and, I've heard our friend Nightwing talk about this, you know, endless times, but the movie Tintin that came out in the original France, Tintang or something, I don't know. that was actually a Stephen Moffat penned movie.
And, yeah, he had been actually originally tapped by Spielberg to do all three because they were supposed to do a trilogy of these things.
Yeah, and I mean, it wasn't the big blockbuster success that, you know, would have spawned a trilogy, but it was actually a really good movie. And I sat down with my kids and I knew that it was a Moffat production going into it, or Moffat, you know, script. So I'm looking for those elements. And it's granted, there's a lot of action and stuff, but I think that was taken out of his hands because it was a feature film.
Right.
So, but the moments where, you know, there was quick dialogue, where there was, you know, the witty banter back and forth, that kind of thing. And the emotional cues were all there. And I'm sitting there like, this is exactly like this in Doctor Who. This is exactly like this one. And it's, you've got those moments that you can see this is clearly a Moffat thing because and those are the big three things that I would say are his element. Yeah. You know, the emotion obviously is a huge thing. He knows how to get us right in the feels.
Mm-hmm.
And he enjoys doing it.
I think so. Yeah, I think he genuinely, because as you said, you know, one of the quotes that stands out most is that he writes what he likes to see.
Mm-hmm.
So he tells stories that entertain himself, and you know, we've joked about the fact that we can tell that, you know, we can see him sitting behind his keyboard typing something out and just giggling at what he knows he's about to do. Because he enjoys it as much as we do consuming it, or at least getting a rise out of people, whether it's positive or negative.
Yeah.
So, yeah, you mentioned the banter, you know, and the idea that his dialogue, when it really starts firing, which is one of the reasons why I think he's done extremely well with Coleman and Capaldi right now, because of the fact that they're capable of doing some of that, you know, that whip crack back and forth, not really sure if they're angry with each other, if they're just both really masters of sarcasm as they're, you know, zinging off of one another. The emotional interplay, yes, we're going to get a lot of criticism. The fact that this, you know, there's so much romance involved in Who right now. Why do we need this? You know, what is this nonsense with couples and babies and weddings and this isn't the Doctor Who that I wanted. Well, okay, that's understandable. There are just as many people out there right now who
who would want that.
Exactly. Who argue that, you know, that Amy and Rory were like the couple next door that they absolutely loved to have over and so forth, and they were so endeared to them. Or you look at all the people out there that name their Twitter handles after Clara and things like that, and you know, and it goes on and on and on. So there are going to be people on either side of the fence through everything. You know, I was going through some articles where they were discussing, you know, the obvious, the RTD versus Moffat eras and so forth, and going on and on and on about the fact that, well, you know, it's clearly, you know, it was a matter of the romances getting out of control, because there was just you know, these periods where RTDs was so stylized and these relationships with romantic relationships with Rose and Mickey, but there was the affection for the Doctor and these love triangles, and we're so glad that Moffat got away from that. And then on the next page, another individual is just bashing. They're like, this has become the Doctor and companion show, and at times it's the companion show that involves the Doctor, because we're just following the romantic involvements of Clara and Danny, and that's just indicative of everything that Moffat's doing these days, where it's so much about a romantic comedy as it is about a sci-fi program, and it's lost its course. I'm sorry, folks. You're going to have to just understand that in a room full of five people, there are four other people thinking differently than you do.
Oh yeah, in a room full of five opinion, there are eight opinions.
Okay, that's more accurate math. Yeah. Yes.
So, you know, that's one thing too, is that, you know, one of the big problems people have had with Moffat is that, you know, they think he's a misogynist. He's very, you know, his scripts are very male heavy, and the women are relegated to specific roles and things like that. And, you know, I remember one thing he said was that he had said, I was called a misogynist because I was reducing women to mothers. Reducing women to mothers. Now, there is possibly the most anti-woman statement I've ever heard. And it is one of those, it's like, I really think that he does enjoy the strong woman. He just sees it from a different angle. Mm. You know, and that's the thing with a lot of things, is that he's not a businessman. He's not a, you know, you put him in charge of the show and say, hey, run this business. And he looks at the script and says, okay, I can do this part. I don't know about the rest of it, but you know, another quote that I've heard from him is that, you know, he said, if anyone said to me, invent a new monster so we can sell more toys, I'd kick them out of my office. Because he is far more concerned about the show, about the story, than he is about how much money it brings in.
Right. Okay. Well, that's going to be something I want to sort of turn that around and hand that back to you on something. If he is intrinsically concerned about the story first and foremost, because this is, you know, this is a show that we tune into. This is fiction.
Yeah.
We want to be told a story. I do not watch reality television in any form because I don't want to know these people that you tell me are real. Uh-huh. I want to be told a story. So if that's the case, what about the criticism that has just evolved, you know, within the last 6 months, that his stories are becoming too complex? He's always written stories that involve a lot of temporal distortions. He loves playing around with some of the, what he believes to be the underpinnings of the Doctor Who program. It has to be emotionally investing. It has to be at times scary. And it has to involve things that have to do with manipulation of time. Your character is a time lord. He travels in a time machine. So there's only so many things you can do with that until you have to start coming at it from a new angle. So is he making this too complicated for the sake of having something new to do?
You know, one of the things I love the most is that there was a statement about Doctor Who, and I can't remember who said it, but they said, you know, you have to make it simple enough for adults, but complex enough for children. And I really think that is one of those great dichotomies that really does sum up this show, is the fact that it's, if you start to make it too complex, the adults are going to start to complain. Mm-hmm. And I don't think that that's any, you know, any shortcoming in the show. I think it's just that I think that people get used to the show a certain way. And now that the show is far more popular than it has ever been in its history, there are a lot more people paying attention to it. And I don't, you know how the it's always the vocal minority that seems to ruin things. And you can have 700 people saying, this is great. I love this show. I think it is fantastic the way it is. I'm just going to sit here and enjoy it. And then you have the 50 people over in the corner screaming their heads off because it's not something that they're used to or not something that they want. And you're not going to pay attention to the people sitting there quietly enjoying their program.
Very true. And this is not just a matter of programming. It's just a matter of the what I think is part of human condition is complainers tend to be louder than people who are satisfied. If you're satisfied, you sit back, you enjoy it. If you're indifferent about it, you generally, you know, withhold your opinions and just observe. The people who take umbrage to something are going to be the ones to stand up on their soapbox and tell you why it sucks. And they will continue to do so because they want to convert. I think there seems to be some sort of a camaraderie in the complaints where you feel better if you can get someone else to go, yeah, damn it. Ah. So and that gives them some sort of a justification.
Right.
If you enjoy a show, you can just say, you know what, that was a great episode. And you go about your way, wait for the next week.
Yeah, no, and I mean, that's a great example. If you look through the comments on something and somebody says, no, I hated this aspect of it. And then you have the next five comments smacking them down saying, no, that was great. You don't see anything else from the first person anymore. They shut up and they go their separate way. But if somebody says something and then you have like two or three people agree with it, you're going to see them comment a lot more.
Yeah.
So I think that is very true that it's just, you know, if people get a voice behind them agreeing with them, then they get a lot more bold.
I think so. You know, for an individual who has penned 36 full episodes, 36, and that's three full seasons that just he has had his hands on. And then a couple of shorts, you know, doing Night of the Doctor and Time Crash and even take Curse of the Fatal Death. This is an individual who knows the story. You know, he knows, you know, he has within his head and within his memory and his adoration for the show, he has ideas that and we've seen it probably, most clearly, in the episodes that get the most praise, you know, things like Blink in those episodes. These are ones where it boils down to allowing him to stay to his strengths. I write witty dialogue. I write things that can hit you in the heartstrings, and I can scare you when I need to. And when I'm doing those three things well, and I know I'm doing it in the Doctor Who universe, I get to tap into the fact that I'm a fan, so I'm going to do it in some ways that show that I appreciate everything that this program has had, you know, leading into it, all of the, you know, all the years and the giants upon whose shoulders we stand.
Mm.
And at the same time, I want to see the show evolve a bit, so I'm going to throw some changes in there, and hopefully, if you appreciate the dialogue and I can make you laugh or make you cry from the emotion, or I can send your kids hiding behind the couch for a second, or I can, you know, make you scared of some inanimate object that always seemed pretty benign before, but not anymore because now I've made it weird.
Yeah.
Then maybe you'll forgive me or run with me with this new turn that I'm taking. What? And that's where he's still having the difficulty.
Well, and I think that, you know, bringing it back to the whole complexity issue, it's, you know, Stephen Moffat is of the opinion, and I'm going to paraphrase here because I don't remember the exact quote, but he said something like, you know, you'll go out of business if you assume that people are stupid. Mm. And I think that that's what it is too, is that he writes expecting his audience to understand. Because let's face it, I mean, you don't find many, you know, many idiots, many stupid people sitting down saying, you know what, I really like that Doctor Who show because it challenges me. It, you know, they're going to be the people that go off and watch, you know, Family Guy. Sorry.
But I get where you're headed with it.
But, you know, that's the thing, though, is that it's... He expects his audience to be able to catch up to where he is and expects them to be okay and understand the fact that the reason why this show is in its 51st year is because of change, because it doesn't stagnate, because it doesn't stay the same, you know, and I think that he understands that just as well as anyone else, if not more so, that you know, you have to reinvigorate things. You have to regenerate things sometimes in order to keep the show going. And, you know, like we brought up before, that there are a lot of new people getting into the show now. A lot of new people that are used to, this is how shows are done. You run it into the ground with the same people that you had at the very beginning until you can't do anymore, and then you end it. You know, and that's what they've been fed their whole lives. That's what they're used to. And, you know, when you get a casting change, everybody notices, and they're talking about it for years, and it's like, oh, well, the other person was better, or this, that. And they're not used to that kind of change.
Right. Yeah, I mean, we heard him mention it most recently, you know, talking about some of the changes going into Series 8 and the fact that they were going to be making some very dramatic changes. And he had said outright, you know, the moment people realize that you're doing something that fits a formula, it's time to throw out the formula.
Mm-hmm.
So I think to a certain degree, he knew or was prepared for some of the dissent that was going to happen. But I think to a certain degree, he was hoping that as many people that got sort of shaken up by this, that said, oh, I don't know if I can get into this new doctor, or I don't know if I can get into the way that these scripts are running right now, or I don't know about these stories that are getting a little, you know, kind of, you know, cerebral or dark.
Mm-hmm.
That, you know, I want my kind of my shiny RTD stuff back again. Well, I think at the same time, he was banking on the fact that there are as many viewers who are saying, okay, all right, this is a different kind of program now. I'm interested to see where they're going to go with it. Or who knows? I would love to see whether or not there are individuals who said, you know what, I just came into this show in this past year.
Yeah.
We don't hear a lot from that, but I'm sure that they're out there because, yeah, you know, as we were saying, those people who are satisfied with it don't tend to speak up, but I know, right, we've run into a couple.
Well, no, like I said, my friend Nightwing, we've talked about it, and he's actually told me a number of times he hated Matt Smith. He didn't think that there, you know, I'm sure he's a great guy kind of thing, but, you know, it wasn't anything against him personally. He didn't like Matt Smith's doctor.
Mm-hmm.
And he is in love with Capaldi. He says anything that guy does is golden. So, you know, it's, you do have those people out there that are wholly on board with the new direction the show has taken.
Mm-hmm.
You just don't hear much because, you know, when you're happy, you don't complain.
Yeah, I guess so. Well, we kind of mentioned the popularity of the show, and, you know, the fact that, you know, while the individuals who do speak up or you know, start to gripe about the couple of aspects of the program that don't click with them, or certain episodes that they think were just a, you know, indicative of the walls crumbling and the skies falling or whatever the case may be, something right is happening because of overall viewership, because of mainstream recognition. You know, the cover of Entertainment Weekly or you know, tell me some of the other mainstream U.S. you know, stateside magazines that picked up things doing, whether it was during the 50th anniversary year or beyond. Now,
mm-hmm,
the shakeup has also just proven that people are paying attention. Now, I know people are going to say right now, well, yeah, but, you know, UK viewership was down this yeah, past series. Okay, mm-hmm, I understand. You know, numbers being what numbers, you can go ahead and we can play statistics all, you know, all year long, because we can also say, you know, by the same token, you know, BBCA on this side of the pond saw their best viewership for the show yet and growing.
Yeah.
So, and then as many people will jump in and say, yeah, but that's just because the show is becoming more Americanized now. So it's appealing to American viewers. He's clearly writing for a U.S. audience now to appeal to them. Well, if that's the case, I'm going to have to argue that all of your previous criticisms about the show getting too complicated and too boring don't apply, because we're Americans.
Yeah, we don't get stuff on the first go around. It takes us a few times.
We want things simple and blowy uppy. It's all in how you want to filter it. But for the individuals who wanna complain about the current pattern or current direction, I'm gonna have to ask you to give it some time to settle, because, you know, these transition periods, whether it was, you know pre RTD, when we were making transitions from doctor to doctor, you could see write-ups from the magazines at the time where they were saying that one of the reasons why there was a casting change was because the show was tanking. It was nearly off the air. But at the same time, as soon as your next individual to step behind the TARDIS console really started to get their legs under them, had writers who understood what that individual was capable of portraying and started handing them scripts that were catered to their strengths, the show would start to recover again, and you'd see these ebbs and flows. Not to say that Series 8 was in any way an ebb,
right?
But if that's the way you're perceiving it, because you're in that, I don't know, phase, or whatever it is, you know, I dare you to stick it out. And yes, we are in for at least another season with Moffat at the helm. Mm-hmm. And I'm personally interested to see what he's going to do, because I think he's genuinely enjoying working with the cast and the staff, the team that he has right now. You know, whether he's got the popular opinion at the moment, he's loving this. And you can tell when you have a group of individuals who are really enjoying what they're doing, the craft that they're putting forward. You see that in the work that they do. You know, we've seen shows before where they hit these lulls because everyone's kind of wondering, wow, is it time for me to start looking for a new gig? Or whatever the case may be. And you see the stitches in the fabric.
Mm-hmm.
So...
yeah. And that's one thing that Moffat has said, is that, you know, he knows that his time to step aside is coming soon. Like, he hasn't put a time on it or anything, or say, no, I'm going to leave after. But he has said that, you know, that he understands his tenure is going to be limited, and that the correct time for him to leave will come very soon.
Right. Or you get the people that actually broke down the math on it and said, well, based on the date that he said, I am closer to my departure than I am from my entrance. And they did the math on it. Like, that, he's gone by 2016. That's the way it works out. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. So
I think he will step down when he believes that the show is on solid footing with mm-hmm. probably an individual, you know, from within his ranks. It's going to be a farm team kind of thing
mm-hmm.
That will come up, whether it's Minchin or you know, if he's still in contact with Beth Willis for her involvement, or whether it's a matter of, you know, Mark Gatiss or Chris Chibnall or one of my personal hopes that it would be Nicholas Briggs, you know, or whatever the case may be. Someone who shares the same sort of passion for the show on the levels that he does, from a writing perspective, from a production perspective, from a directing perspective, from a franchise and business perspective.
Mm-hmm.
You know, maybe someone who's got better PR skills than he does. I don't know. I don't think that's personally one of his criteria, but I think
fingers crossed.
I think he looks at it story first.
Yeah.
And I have no problem with that.
Yeah, absolutely. So I think really going through this and figuring out what it is that I like about Stephen Moffat, I'm actually far more comfortable with him as a showrunner now that I've actually had to make this argument. Like, once I had to put everything into words and realize, like, where I stood on the issue, I'm like, you know, I actually kind of like him as showrunner. I mean, I will endlessly, you know, tease him for Moffat-splaining, you know, but
yeah.
But that's, you know, I think that the show is in a great spot. I think it's fantastic. And I don't think that there's anything that we really are left wanting here at this point. Yeah. I mean, obviously some fans are, but
yep.
I'm comfortable with who we've got, you know, running the show right now.
Yeah. I do understand that some people get upset at some of the decisions that he makes about playing with, you know, the premise of the laws of time or whatever the case may be. I mean, there are going to be aspects of mm-hmm. some of the things that he writes, you know, literally some of the decisions within the story
yeah.
that upset people. And I get that. But I think that's a good thing, because that means that at any time you've got a writer who wants to try to push the envelope in a certain direction, and then those fans say, no, you know what, I don't like that. You're shaking up canon, or you're backtracking on something, or you've belittled a character, or whatever the case may be. That's constructive criticism. But it's a matter of, there's a clear delineation between constructive criticism and a witch hunt. And I think we're well beyond witch hunt phase now. I mean, this yeah. is something where when you've got sites devoted to seeing him, you know, drawn and quartered, you know, it's a bit much. This is a television show, folks. Mm-hmm. These are stories that we love to hear, and stories that we like to tell each other and write, you know, fan fiction or whatever the case may be. I'm willing to bet there's some fan fiction out there that makes some decisions that would make you throw up on yourself.
Oh, yeah. I've read a few of them.
Sure. But, and yes, you're going to hold, you know, your principal head writer slash, you know, executive producer showrunner to a higher standard, understandably so. But that's also a matter of a much larger audience. So, no, you can't make everyone happy. And as the show rises in popularity and takes on new viewers, now you've just got a larger pool of which that percentage grows, you know, as well. So yeah. the dissenters increase in their ranks.
Yeah.
Just like everyone else. But look at what the listeners have to say. Because we wanted to turn it over to them and see, you know, are we digging our own grave here?
Yeah. For doing this? So Ben, we quoted before, Ben said, the Grand Moff, what could be said? As a writer, he has written 95% of the stories, of the best stories of the modern era. As showrunner, he has embraced the classical era to such a degree that I have felt that in certain ways we are reliving the Hinchcliffe-Holmes era with a twist. Is he perfect? No, not at all. Does he need a PR manager to do the interviews for him? Maybe. But certain clickbait sites need to stop editing and a comment from him and twisting it to suit their own purpose. Finest hour, day of the doctor. Anyone bringing my doctor back to the TV screen has my respect. I do dread the day he announces his departure.
Okay.
So I fully agree that a lot of the hate from Moffat has come from the sites that are like, that are very sensationalized. And it's like, oh, you're never going to believe what Moffat said. And they take, you know, five words completely out of context and post that as a headline. And then you go in and they write this whole story around it. And at the very bottom, like they'll put, you know, the entire quote and they're like, you know, well, this is what the story actually was, but we're, you know, we think he's just covering his ass here. And, you know, and I think that that is a huge part of the problem here.
It can be. Well, again, you know, it's a matter of it's a lot easier to get people's attention when you're screaming your hatred towards something than you are, you know, jumping out there and just saying, I loved it. I loved it. I loved it.
It's, yeah. But I do absolutely have to agree with them. For anyone that wants to hate on Moffat, the four simple words, day of the doctor. I've yet to hear someone complain about that and say, no, I absolutely disliked it. There was nothing in that redeeming. Like, whatever your opinion is on the bringing Gallifrey back or, you know, not actually destroying it debacle, you know, that's 5 minutes at the end of the movie or the end of the episode or whatever you want to call it. But the rest of it was solid. It was fantastic.
Yeah, it was a straight up tribute to where the show has been, where the show has come, and where the show is headed.
Exactly.
Which was what he set out to do when he started writing. So, mm-hmm. You know, we got an interesting question that sort of tied into what we were discussing earlier from Stargate Pioneer when he was saying, you know, knowing that he's not part of the industry, or you're understanding, you know, the some of the organization of responsibility and when these shows get put together, he wanted to know what the entire production team staff really kind of looks like and who's responsible for what aspect of it. And specifically, you know, whether or not there are constrained timelines that they have to work under in order to get so he could, you know, as a viewer, get a picture within his own head of how successfully any showrunner or staff does. You know, whether it's him or whether it's the people, you know, J.R.R. Martin for Game of Thrones or Walking Dead or, you know, take it all the way through. Is this something where you can even realistically say it's his fault? It's her bad move. It's they rushed this thing out too soon because they were trying to get, you know, they were trying to meet a deadline that was unrealistic because it was the network's fault. Or who, you know, is it really a matter of a blame game, or is it, you know, is a shared responsibility? So
I do find it interesting the list of shows he listed here. He's got Game of Thrones, Walking Dead, Arrow, Justified, Almost Human, which is gone now. Mm-hmm. Terra Nova, also gone. Firefly, Ice Road Truckers, Sherlock, or Doctor Who.
Yeah.
That's quite the potpourri of TV shows you've got there.
Yeah, well.
Yeah.
But it's an absolutely valid point. You know, mm-hmm. He happens to be the individual in the largest chair right now. So, you know, please direct all hate mail towards this individual. but it's really also a matter of this is a shared responsibility. He is not, you know, the man is not an island. He does take feedback and interaction with the rest of his team. You know, if you're curious to know who are the individuals there, there's a lot of information freely available to sort of see who the rest of his you know, production staff and his writing team is, whether you have an individual who is referred to as head writer or not, because that's always in a state of flux. But some of the things that we may not ever have that much information on, unless it comes up in a direct interview, is like we've wondered, you know, when someone is handed the opportunity to write a script, how often does it come back for revisions, edits, and commentary? Or is it a matter of do you have an individual that you check in with on a regular basis and there are steering corrections along the entire writing process?
Mm-hmm.
I got a feeling that probably differs from individual to individual based on their personal process or right. The way that show has historically run. You know, in the classic days, it was a matter of you got handed a skeleton for, all right, we need you to write something that's going to be a 4-episode story. And this time around, because we haven't done it yet this season and we have to, it has to have Daleks in it. Go.
Right. Yeah, it's, I honestly don't know what the process is like, at least in British TV. I mean, there's plenty of ways you can find out about American TV here, but for the British TV, I don't know. And I've heard varying reports to the point where I think that it's a lot of, you know, it depends on the showrunner. It depends on the network. It depends on the show itself. You know, I don't think there's a set, this is how things are usually run in the business. I think it's just, there's a lot of variables it might change from one series to the next. I mean, you look at series 7 and it looks like, you know, Moffat threw down a timeline on a table and said, okay, I'll be back at the end of the year. You know, yeah. And then series 8 is much more cohesive where, you know, you can see that he had a much bigger guiding hand saying, okay, no, this has to tie into this and we have to do this, that, and the other. So I don't think that there's any, you know, standard way of looking at it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Or it may have been something where, he and his cabinet, because I'm just going to refer to them that way. It just seems easiest to describe them that way. You know, were able to go to their writers as they were tapped and said, okay, you know, we're going to have, and Haley wondered about this too, whether they actually all had a kind of a group sit down at any point where he said, you know, he and his team said, you know, here's what we'd like to be able to convey. These are some of the themes that we want to carry forward. This is the mission statement for the series this year, that we want to be able to get this, you know, we want to move from here to here to here. We want these characters to have this path, this journey, and the rest in terms of some of the incidentals that happen in there or other characters that you want to bring to the table. Fantastic. We're going to leave that to your creative input, but here's our through line.
Right.
You know, maybe that's the case. Maybe that's what went well this season, or maybe it's just a matter of because they had writers who knew what they wanted to convey and just sort of, you know, they nailed it on the first couple of shots. It didn't require a lot of tweaking. It didn't look like something that was hodgepodge together.
Mm-hmm.
We don't know, but I will say this for those people who are genuinely curious to know, go to conventions where writers are going to be on panels. Ask them because they'll talk about it. They are not sworn to secrecy about the writing process. You know, there may be certain things that they can't discuss about material yet to be aired, but you know, it's not like they're signing non-disclosures that say, oh, well, we're not allowed to tell you, you know,
right,
how we decided to, you know, to introduce this ancillary character because that's confidential. No, they love to talk about it. That's their craft.
Exactly. Yep. So then the next comment that we got was from Michael, who said, in many respects, Stephen Moffat is the Facebook of Doctor Who showrunners, and that he is often unfairly demonized. I take issue with the idea of Facebook being unfairly demonized.
You see, you can either be part of the solution, Jay. But yeah, well, this is what we're saying, that, you know, if you're in the habit of pointing fingers, you know, it's easiest to point the finger at the largest object in the room because it's the easiest one to see. And if he is currently the face of it, you know, we don't often get to see, you know, Brian Minchin pop up and say, hey, I had a lot to do with Series 8. And you!
Right, yeah.
You! You're the one I'm after!
Yeah, that's very true. Then Bobby Honeycutt wrote in, said, I'm definitely Team Moffat, but I would get the torches and pitchforks if another potential showrunner promised the Ronnie.
Yes. Okay. Well, we get it. We get it.
Yeah. Dead. Jake on Twitter said he modernized the show for the better, changed the tone of the series to make it slicker, and wrote some of the best stories.
Right. Not always happening within the same season.
Yeah. Right.
But yeah. Modernization of the show. I don't know. I'll have to ask Jake to give me some quantification on that.
I would agree that he brought a lot of the classic show to the modern audience. I would definitely agree with that. That's what you're getting at, then yes, absolutely, I agree with you. But because I mean, he's brought a lot of elements from the classic series to an audience that has never heard of it.
Right.
Yeah. You know, I mean, you look at the Ice Warriors, whether you like the episode or not, but you know, that's a villain that people who came in with Matt Smith never would have known anything about. And now, you know, they actually did a fairly good job of it.
Rutons.
Yeah. The Rutons, the Zygons.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah.
Now changing the tone of the series to make it slicker. I would say, yeah. Slick is actually a pretty good descriptor of it, because there is genuinely a tone or a feel to the program right now that is definitive. You know, if you were to look back at Series 7, you could say, well, it looked like it kind of flipped halfway through and it didn't really have it, or every episode felt different. Mm-hmm. You know, while there were certain ones that I enjoyed and certain ones I didn't enjoy, I didn't see something that said, you know, this is where Doctor Who is right now. But Series 8 definitely has a very clear characteristic to it that I guess slick is a good word. Production quality, mm-hmm. and just the nature of it genuinely feels polished, whether it's telling a story that you enjoy or not. That's up to you, but it definitely has a very distinctive feel.
Yeah, that's very true. I can wholly agree with that one.
Yeah. And as for writing some of the best stories, you know, that's subjective,
I would agree.
but even before he had the showrunner, you know, chair to sit in, I mean, the guy won, you know, more Hugo Awards for this program than I can count. And, you know, 2006, 7, 8, he was winning them consecutively and was beating out shows like Battlestar Galactica at the peak of its writing, you know, to take these awards home. And Hugo's are nothing to be scoffed at. I mean, these are very keen critics for handing out those awards.
So next week we are going to be talking about the difference between Nuvians and the old guard. And is there a segregation factor? If you're a fan of the classic series, do you feel like you're better than the people, you know, the Matt Smith fans? Mm-hmm. Or, you know, if you've come into new Who, you know, if you've come into Doctor Who since RTD brought it back or even more recently, do you feel like you're, you know, often, you know, condescended to or whatever? Let us know what your opinion is on this. And if there's, you know, something that you've, a trend or anything like that, we'd love to hear different opinions on this from everybody, from the classic fans and the new fans.
Right. Or the what you have witnessed as far as some of the crossover. You know, we know a number of you know, self-appointed new Whovians who, as a result of the popularity of the 50th anniversary and things, have started to delve back. Or classic fans who love to rally around the fact that I was there through the dark years.
Right.
You know, I carried this show, but I do love what it's doing right now. You know, it's a different program, but I love it just the same. You know, and there's all the different factions. You know, mm-hmm. is that justified? Can we all get along and kumbaya a little bit?
Yeah, I mean, we'll see.
We're gonna solve it all next week.
Oh yeah, completely and totally. So, but I, you know, like I said, I think that Stephen Moffat is a great showrunner, and I'm actually far more comfortable with him now than I was previously. So when he does decide that he is going to leave, there's going to be a part of me that's sad. There's going to be a part of me that's, you know, very excited for what's to come too, but that's because I'm a trained Whovian and I know that change can bring awesome things.
Yeah. Yeah. And I do honestly think that because of the fact that we know of what a fan of the show that he is, that if he is involved in any way, unless for some reason BBC Wales decided to run him out of town on a rail and put someone else in his position, that he's going to have some say in the individual who takes over, whether it be 2016 or whatever that's going to happen. And I trust that he's going to be looking for an individual who carries the same passion for the show and for the franchise that he does. So
mm-hmm. yeah,
I'm positive about that too.
Yeah.
We had mentioned, the fact that, one of the ways you can get a lot of the answers to the questions about the sort of the way shows are assembled, these shows are assembled, is to talk to people at cons. We've got Gallifrey One coming up in less than a month now, and announcements happening all over the place about things that are changing as far as the attendees and the talent. We'll be talking about that in a minute, but. Please let us know if you're going to be attending Gallifrey One. We're going to be, all over there as well. Trying to make sure that we get a chance to rally up with some recognizable faces out there too. So give us a holler. Let us know if you're going to be at the event. We'll let you know where we're going to be on any given day. We'll be doing some live tweeting from there as well. But yeah, we want to make sure that we get a chance to rally up with folks that are going to be on the left coast for that event.
Yes. Yeah, definitely. So we do have a little bit of news. We talked about this previously, that the whole Netflix possibly dropping Doctor Who and many other BBC shows, and
the sky is falling. The sky is falling.
Turns out it's not happening. Netflix is keeping Doctor Who. So everybody, come out of your panic rooms. Everything is going to be okay.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And, we did mention before, this happens every year. And for some reason this year, it just blew up far more than it ever has before.
Because of clickbait articles. That's what it's all about. I think
they actually did get closer to the deadline than I remember previously. Before, it's always been, like mid-December or early January when they renew it. So it hasn't gotten there like, holy crap, I've only got a week and a half left kind of thing.
I got a theory about that. You just think there is probably, compared to last year, just within the course of last year, I think they've picked up a lot more BBC originated mm-hmm. content.
Yeah.
So if you're doing contract renewals, now you have a larger body of work that needs to be considered on the table for when they're, if they're determining what the cost of the licensing is going to be,
yeah.
if it's done on an individual program basis, or if they're purchasing the licensure for these in bulk, or whatever the case may be, it's a more complicated process.
Right.
So I can see it taking a little longer.
Yeah. And I don't ever think that Doctor Who was a problem, because, show of hands, how many people actually came to Doctor Who through Netflix? There are a huge number of us that's where we picked it up. That's where we started from. And so, the BBC is not going to turn away that avenue. But, and at the same time, Netflix knows there are hundreds of thousands of people, at least dozens, who the only reason why they have Netflix is because they want Doctor Who.
Right.
So it's beneficial for both of them to keep it. I think that the reason why it took so long was the other BBC shows. It's, do you really want to keep, this show on there for this reason? It's going to cost you this much. And it's the rest of them that were keeping it all, in flux. So, mm-hmm. But then, like Keir said earlier, I think a huge problem with it was the most often respectable, nerd blogs that were acting like this is something that is completely new.
Right.
And because, let's face it, you saw something that said, holy crap, Netflix is losing Doctor Who, and you said, I need to know more about this, and you clicked on it, and they got paid. Mm-hmm. And then you shared it on Facebook, and everybody else said, holy crap, and they clicked on it, and they got paid, and they got paid, and they got paid, and they got paid. So, I think that this was just people are going to panic about this, and I'm going to profit.
Yeah. Yeah. So. Well, in actual news, stuff that you did not see coming. We're into our Series 9 production. We talked that principal filming and location photography has started. And along with that, one of the individuals involved with some of the location choices and things of that sort is their director of photography, Ali Assad. And he apparently was doing some reconnoitering for locations, as he tweeted, and mentioned that he was headed out to Spain to do so.
They're going back to the moon. It's the sequel to Kill the Moon. That's what's going to happen here. No.
Yeah,
no.
That's precisely what they're going to do. Yeah. They're also going to unearth the cyborg gunslinger that they use in Town Called Mercy. So it's, you know, it's a matter of just getting some locations chosen, which means they're going to be doing some shots that require some, you know, some large scenery locales that don't have to get shot in a quarry just outside Liverpool. So nice to know that they're going to continue to venture out there. As far as some other news, there are going to be a couple of good resources out there as these little bits and pieces of production news filter out. There are a couple sites, and I'll make sure that I mention them in some of the comments that come along with this episode posting, that are going to be building the game plan for Series 9. Okay, here's the directors we have so far. Here's the writers we have so far. Here are the episode titles we have so far, locations and so forth. Because, let's face it, we love to gather this all in and hug it closely to ourselves as these little news items build to the anticipation of Series 9 airing. And rather than us reinventing the wheel, I mean, we'll give you the announcements as they come about, but there are some highly commendable resources out there that will cull them together for us as a viable resource. DoctorWhoTV.uk and so forth are some very qualified and credible sources, unlike the Mirror and such. So we'll keep you posted on that too.
Yeah. And then our last news item is Gallifrey 1 now with more Torchwood.
It's Naoko.
Yeah. So Naoko Mori, who played Tosh in Torchwood, has joined the guest list as well as Andrew Cartmell, actually. So it's kind of interesting that we mentioned J&T earlier.
That's true. So we had nearly a full Torchwood box set going on there. We did lose Kaio, and so
right. Yeah, Reese will not be there, but also Yanto, but Garrett David Lloyd, but he was never announced, so you know, we didn't lose him. So
no, you wouldn't put it past him to do some sort of weird drop in appearance. So he's been known to crash cons before.
That would be fun, though. That would be very fun. We also unfortunately did lose Mark Shepard, who isn't going to be joining us there. So
It. I'm out.
I know. I was looking forward to him too. But yeah, so it's going to be very exciting to do this. And I honestly, the closer we get, the more amped up I am. And it's just, yay! Yeah. They all are also having the receptions in the evenings on Friday and Saturday. Mm-hmm. And right now, actually about 5 minutes ago, they posted on their Facebook page that there are 10 tickets left for the 6 o'clock Friday reception, and the other three are sold out. So if you want to get in to see Alex Kingston and Eve Miles, it's probably already too late, but there's a chance.
That's true. Yeah. All of a sudden, like they were doing a lot of advanced reception sales when it was going to be Alex Kingston and Gemma Redgrave, and Gemma had to switch her schedule around a little bit, and Eve was able to step in, which has got to be an interesting pair of individuals sharing a dais right there.
I'm seriously considering my opinion to bow out.
Yeah.
I don't know. I might want to go in that night and get tossed out early.
But you could earn the ribbon. I got ejected from from the Gallifrey 1 reception.
Well, apparently you do get an exclusive ribbon if you get into the receptions, and I would ask for a custom. Yeah, that's what I need.
I want the badge of dishonor that comes along with it.
Speaking of ribbons, I don't know that we've actually announced this, but we actually will have ribbons for GPR listeners at Gallifrey 1.
Yeah. We will be, obviously, with all the things to distract you and occupy your time and trying to structure your time, Jay and I are going to be scattered throughout the weekend. But if individuals are able to track down either one of us at any given point, we will have paired off ribbons that sort of work in tandem to complete the Whovian quote. Obviously, for those of you who have attended any sort of Whovian conventions before, the commemorative ribbons that people tend to daisy chain down their entry badges tend to get very long. In fact, I remember when I was at Long Island, one of the security guards who was popping into a lot of panels, she had hers that wrapped all the way around her shoulder like a bandolier and met again over the top of her shoulder. And she had, it was easily a good 120 of them that she had chained together.
I've seen pictures of Fourth Doctor cosplays where the scarf is these ribbons. So
yeah, so we'll be sure to have ours as well. So if you find one of us, then you're just going to have to go out and find the other one of us as well.
Yeah.
Which we enjoy anyway.
Oh, that's all the news that we've got for this week. So, yeah, I think that's about it. I think
Haley, got anything else to add? No, I didn't think so.
Yeah. Chiming in as usual.
Don't worry, we're going to get some of that bat's milk. We'll have it right as rain in no time. Unless, oh, Perry took the last dose. I'm sorry.
Too soon, dude. Too soon.
Send your celery to Haley at GallifreyPublicRadio.com.
It's okay. Perry will get choked out next episode. It'll be fine. Well, this has been episode 121 of Gallifrey Public Radio. Until next week, this is Jay saying, as Stephen Moffat said, I never go online. The internet stuff is bonkers. You must not look at it.
And this is Kish saying, it's been a real cracker.
We'll see you guys next week.
Thanks for joining us for another episode of Gallifrey Public Radio. Join us each week for new episodes. We love getting feedback from listeners, so don't hesitate to share your thoughts with us. You can email us at feedback@gallifreypublicradio.com, tell us on Twitter @GallifreyRadio, or on Facebook at facebook.com/GallifreyPublicRadio. You can also leave us a voicemail for inclusion in future shows at 210-802-1477. That's 210-802-1GPR. You can also go to GunnaGeek.com to check out lots of other high-quality, geek-centric shows, or visit forums.gunnageek.com to talk about anything geeky with us or the community. Music by Beyond the Epilogue and Retcon Addict.
Gallifrey Public Radio is copyright 2015.